I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Republican presidential candidates met in Milwaukee last night for their fourth debate. This one focused largely on the economy. There were four at the undercard debate and eight on the main stage. There were wide-ranging questions on the minimum wage, on debt, taxes, government spending, Dodd-Frank, and a few questions on foreign policy. And there were some feisty disagreements over immigration policy, whether big banks should be allowed to fail, who's a true conservative, and near the end of the evening, whether Vladimir Putin can be trusted. Donald Trump got booed by the audience when he complained about Carly Fiorina interrupting everyone. And one of the moderators got booed when she mentioned Hillary Clinton's extensive resume. We want to talk about last night's presidential debate. And joining us are Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And he was a chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. Jared Bernstein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Also with us is Jennifer Rubin, and she's the Right Turn columnist for The Washington Post. And Jennifer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure.
Jennifer, let me begin with you. Fox Business Network promised that they would do a better job than CNBC did on their debate. Did the moderators do better?
That's an awfully low bar to climb over, but I think they did. I think it was a very deliberate effort on their part to stick to the facts, stick to the specifics of mostly economic policy, as you indicated. I thought the questions were good. My complaint in many of these debates is that the moderators could actually do more follow-up, catching the contestants, if you will, the participants in factual errors, for example. But overall, I thought they did a very good job. There were a lot of different questions. They covered a lot of territory. And I think we actually learned something, not only about these candidates, but about some fissures in the Republican Party on foreign policy, on trade, and on immigration.
Which I do want to pick up on. Jared, was this a substantive debate last night?
I think it was, especially relative to some of the previous ones. I think a lot of the substance didn't quite add up if you kind of look behind the some of the talking points at the numbers. But I kind of agree that the moderators kept things on pace. They could have been punchier in some of the follow-ups, and some of the questions were kind of softball-y. But generally, I would agree that it was pretty substantive.
Were there any omissions from your perspective, Jennifer, where that was focused largely on the economy? Were there things that should have been asked that weren't?
Well, I think there was some question. There could have been more, and there should be more for these candidates on all of their tax plans. There was a little bit of discussion with that with Ted Cruz. These plans are, to put it generously, very ambitious. They all have extreme revenue shortfall problems. And I think pressing these candidates as to how they are going to make up that gap while simultaneously increasing defense spending and promising to further pay down our debt, which is going on $19 trillion, is a math problem that not many of them have solved. So I would like for continued questioning on that front. It was also surprising that for a Republican debate in which everyone is touting their ability to jumpstart the economy, there wasn't that much discussion of how to promote growth, how to promote upward mobility, how to promote wage growth in the United States. And I think that's a problem for both parties. There was a small reference to this actually in the undercard debate with Governor Christie, who mentioned that with zero interest rates, if there is further recession, you don't have anywhere to go. You can't go to negative interest rates. But other than that, there wasn't a whole lot of discussion on the subject. How does one promote growth? Is it only through the tax code? What are the other policies? And in that regard, I think the folks who are in favor of a more liberal immigration policy would do well to make the affirmative case for immigration. It is an element in a pro-growth policy and a pro-growth approach. We do need the best and brightest from around the world. Very interestingly, I was watching the debate with a group of graduate students at Stanford University yesterday, and I think their reaction to I think sort of the lack of worldliness, if you will, the lack of appreciation for an integrated international economy was very telling. In some ways, they look a little bit inward-looking, a little bit small-minded, and I think we really need Canada, especially those who have the background, Carly Fiorina, for one, who was an international businesswoman, to talk about America in the world, about the intersection of trade and immigration, and to really talk about how we continue spur growth and integrate our economy more closely with our neighbors, even in this continent.
Well, and Jared, I want to give you a chance to respond to that. And I also just want to say that we're going to play some back and forth about immigration in just a moment or two. Any omissions from your perspective, Jared, that weren't asked, wasn't talked about last night, that you think is important for the economy?
Yeah, I think jobs. I didn't hear enough about concrete ways to generate more job creation. Now, we actually happen to be doing pretty well on that front right now. The unemployment rate is low, but the unemployment rate is biased down by a couple of nuances in the data. So I do think that the quantity and quality of jobs is a critical point for candidates from both parties to talk a lot more about. Let me respond to some of Jennifer's points.
Sure.
When I said a minute ago that some of the numbers were squishy on how they get to what they want to do based on their tax plans, I was referring to precisely what Jennifer was raising there. So there was an interesting exchange that got some notoriety this morning between Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, where Rubio said, if you want to defend this nation, you're going to have to invest more in defense, and accused Paul of being more of an isolationist. Well, the problem with that, putting aside whether it makes sense from a foreign policy standpoint, is that Rubio's tax plan, according to one scorer here in D.C., the Citizens for Tax Justice Group, loses about $12 trillion in revenue over 10 years, $11.8 trillion, because he cuts taxes really aggressively. I mean, he really just goes after the tax code. He cuts out completely any taxes on capital gains or dividends income, and that accrues mostly to those at the top of the income scale, so it's a regressive tax cut as well. But putting that aside, just in terms of revenue flow, there's just absolutely no way you can have that a tax cut of that magnitude and increase defense spending and not do anything about the Social Security or Medicare, the social insurance programs, which he pledges to keep off the table, and pay interest on the debt. I mean, that just doesn't add up. And so while he may have scored a point there in terms of his attack on Paul's isolationism, the numbers in his budgets don't get even close to supporting his aspirations there.
Well, speaking, you know, Jennifer, if you don't mind, just only because we have that queued up, and since Jared mentioned that, let me just play this little clip, and then Jennifer, I'll give you a chance to weigh in. And again, this is the Republican presidential candidates Marco Rubio and Rand Paul. They're sparring over money, monetary and military policy, and this is from last night's debate. Let's give it a listen.
I know that the world is a safer and better place when America is the strongest military power in the world.
Marco, I don't think we're any safer. I do not think we are any safer from bankruptcy court. As we go further and further into debt, we become less and less safe. This is the most important thing we're going to talk about tonight. Can you be a conservative and be liberal on military spending? Can you be for unlimited military spending and say, oh, I'm going to make the country safe? No, we need a safe country. But, you know, we spend more on our military than the next 10 countries combined. I want a strong national defense, but I don't want us to be bankrupt.
Jennifer, I thought that was a really interesting interchange. You want to weigh in on that?
Sure. I just want to correct something that Jared said. Marco Rubio is not one who says we shouldn't touch entitlement programs. That's Mike Huckabee and a few others. He actually does want to reform those programs, and there are considerable savings. I would agree with Jared absolutely that Rubio is one of those, however, where the numbers don't quite add up, to put it mildly. I think there you had kind of a classic argument between two factions within the Republican Party. One wants to spend less on defense. One does not perceive the dangers overseas as great as others. On the other side, you have Marco Rubio making an argument. It's a very dangerous world. It's gotten a lot more dangerous in the last few years, and we have to invest in defense. I think it behooves all of the candidates who are coming up with these tax schemes to lay it out there. My own view is that Republicans tend to put too much emphasis when we're talking about job creation and growth on the tax code. It's one element, I think, of a pro-growth message. But there are lots of other things that we could be doing in energy policy, education policy, trade. I also thought that there was a bit of a missed opportunity to talk about Asia. There was some discussion of the TPP. Very amusingly, Donald Trump did not seem to understand
that
China was not party to that agreement. And in fact, it's a good reason to have the TPP. But I think Republicans, Democrats alike, and unfortunately Democrats have gone down the protectionist road as well. They both need to, I think, explain to the American people the intersection of national security in Asia, trade, and our own economic interests. I think that's vitally important. It's a really good example of where foreign policy, navigation of the seas, for example, in the South China Sea, is essential. The administration, I think, recently did the right thing in trying to make that clear that China does not control the waters around these artificial islands. So I would like to see that sort of approach. I think what you heard also from the audience was very telling, and that is the Republican Party these days is very hawkish. And that's one reason why Marco Rubio is at, you know, in the high teens and Rand Paul is at around 3%. Rand Paul's message is right now not resonating with the Republican Party.
And about a minute.
So let me just
go ahead,
respond to one point there. So what Rubio says on retirement benefits and Medicare, and Social Security and Medicare, is that he wants to hold harmless current and near retirees. Now, in other Republican plans, that means that they won't touch the large entitlement programs for 10 years. So he hasn't specified the number of years, but he's clearly said that initially he will hold harmless, meaning he won't cut benefits for elderly people. So Jennifer and I just have a factual disagreement there as to what he means. But I do think that either way you cut it, the numbers don't add up. Look, on the jobs point, I really do think that there's a real hole, and I would argue that it's been kind of there on – I haven't heard enough of this on both sides. And I agree with Jennifer that the idea that you can accomplish the kind of job, wage, income growth, that you can put downward pressure on this inequality problem that's been so pronounced simply by tweaking the tax code and especially by aggressively cutting the tax code at the very top – that's just been disproved by history time and time again. And it's actually kind of a head-scratcher for me. I mean, maybe Jennifer has insights into this, as to why, after I think this kind of supply-side trickle-down approach worked very badly for Mitt Romney electorally, why so many Republicans continue to pursue this kind of fairy dust cut.
Well, hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about last night's GOP presidential debate. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, we're getting two perspectives on last night's GOP presidential debate. Jennifer Rubin is the Right Turn columnist for The Washington Post. Jared Bernstein is senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And you can join the conversation. Give us a call, especially if you watched last night's debate, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me put something else on the table here, since you both have been talking about jobs and wages. The very first question had to do with hiking the minimum wage. It was put to Dr. Ben Carson. It also was in part of that question involved the $15 an hour wage that some protesters are demanding or asking for. This was a question that was put to Ben Carson. He said, and I'm looking at my notes that I wrote last night, that taxes are too high. He also said that wages are too high. But he seemed to, Jennifer, flip-flop on the minimum wage, saying he opposed raising the minimum wage, something that he supported not so long ago.
Yeah, I think the specific quote about wages being too high may have been with Donald Trump, but you're right, they both took that position. Dr. Carson remains a mystery to me.
A mystery, yes,
as to what his positions are and exactly what his philosophical bent is. So I think he has changed positions, and I'm not understanding precisely why he took one position and now he takes the other. I think this is an area fraught with peril for Republicans. As Jared knows very well, it's a very popular position to support raising the minimum wage. And in fact, you see on their own, without government intervention, many private employers doing this now. I think Republicans have to have a response other than the fact, which may in fact be accurate, that when you raise the minimum wage, you will get less hiring at the lower end of the economic scale, which hurts, as Dr. Parsons correctly said in this case, teen youth employment. The answer, I think, for Republicans, and it wasn't discussed, I think, in a way that would have been more informative for the public, is various ideas that are floating around on the Republican side regarding the earned income tax credit, which is another way of subsidizing work and wages. Actually, Marco Rubio, although he, as Jared correctly says, puts forth a plan that does not have any tax whatsoever on dividends and capital gains, he also does some rather creative things, as does Joe Bush, with trying to support those very same workers, not by raising the minimum wage, but providing, in essence, a government subsidy for that wage for people who are working. I think for Dr. Carson and for others who are making an argument against the minimum wage, they had better explain what they intend to do for people at the bottom end of the economic ladder, because simply saying we're opposed to it is not going to fit very well politically with the American people. So I think it behooves them to say, this is why I'm opposed to it, but here's what I intend to do for basically, low-wage earners.
Jared, let me just put the question slightly to you, only because I did have a question about looking at the minimum wage of 50, 60 years ago. If that had kept up with inflation, do you know what the minimum wage today would be?
I think it would be somewhere around $12, is my guess. Certainly wouldn't be 15. By the way, I think that it was Trump who said wages are too high. Now, maybe he slipped, but that struck me as a very strange thing for a candidate to say, particularly someone who says, let's make America great again, and particularly if you wrap your head around the fact that for lots of workers, wages have been really stagnant for decades now. Now, recently, there's been more of a bump because inflation's been so low, but just over the long term, most people hearing his voice would not think, boy, my problem is my wages are too high. Look, on the minimum wage, I think the interesting part, I actually thought that was a good question, and I think the interesting part of the question was that it was framed in terms of $15 an hour, and lots of Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, by the way, will tell you that, in fact, the minimum wage for the nation, the national minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, should be lower than that. $12 an hour is, I believe, the number she's signed on to, and that's actually a bill that's in the Congress, but not going anywhere for obvious gridlock reasons. I actually think that makes sense as a national level. I think 15 makes sense in particular places in the country where the wage and the price base is very high. Mm-hmm. But if you go to places where wages are low and prices are low, $15 for a minimum wage would be too high. So it's more of a kind of a surgical thing when you get to that number.
I do want to play another clip from last night, and we were talking about it earlier about the disagreement, the fight even over immigration policy. And this is a small section. This is Republican presidential candidates John Kasich, Donald Trump, and Jeb Spar sparring over immigration policy from last night's debate. And it begins with John Kasich basically saying to Donald Trump that his immigration policy is a fantasy. Let's give it a listen.
Fact is, all I'm suggesting, we can't ship 11 million people out of this country children would be terrified, and it will not work.
Thank you. Mr. Trump, you've had a good...
Built an unbelievable company worth billions and billions of dollars. I don't have to hear from this man. Believe me. I don't have to hear from him.
Mr. Trump, you yourself said let Governor Bush speak. Governor Bush.
Thank you, Donald, for allowing me to speak at the debate. That's really nice of you. Really appreciate that. What a generous man you are. 12 million illegal immigrants, to send them back, 500,000 a month, is just not possible. And it's not embracing American values. And it would tear communities apart. And it would send a signal that we're not the kind of country that I know America is. And even having this conversation sends a powerful signal. They're doing high fives in the Clinton campaign right now when they hear this.
Jennifer, Donald Trump got booed several times last night. Are Republicans beginning to turn on him, do you think?
It was very interesting, wasn't it? Not only in that episode, but when he accused Carly Fiorina of interrupting him and at a couple other junctures. What is very difficult is to assess whether the people in that auditorium are representative of the GOP electorate as a whole. My own theory is that it skews towards what we would refer to as more establishment Republicans. These are the people who have connections to go get tickets or maybe can even travel to go to an event like this. Those people may be much more sympathetic than the electorate as a whole in terms of the position that Governor Bush was advocating. I did think it was interesting, however, that you finally do have some people directly pushing back on Donald Trump and some of these more ludicrous positions that he is taking. Going back to something that Jared said, what is so interesting is how contradictory his positions are. On one hand, he says wages are too high. We should not be raising them anymore. On the other hand, he says the reason for excluding immigrants is that it puts downward pressure on wages.
That's right.
So which is it? I'm not sure what he's trying to accomplish here. But let's not get logical, or let's not talk about the facts, because that would completely mess things up. I do think there is a heartfelt sentiment in the Republican Party that they, for both political reasons, economic reasons, they don't want to go down this road of sort of a nativist approach to politics. If you actually look at the polls, and Whit Ayers has done some wonderful polling in this regard, when you look at actual Republican voters as opposed to a segment of very loud people on talk radio and elsewhere, you will find that they actually are amenable to a reasonable immigration plan, whether it's a path to citizenship or a path to legalized status. It is going to be very interesting, both in the remaining time that we have in the primaries, which really haven't even begun, as well as in the general election. If the Republicans do nominate someone like Governor Bush, like Senator Rubio, how strongly they advocate their positions, and whether they make the case to Hillary Clinton that she and the president did not fulfill their promise in the first 2 years when they had control of the Congress. They did not pursue immigration reform. So I think that would be a very interesting kind of turnabout in the general election when you have Republicans potentially being rather strong advocates of immigration reform.
And that's Jennifer Rubin. She's the Right Turn columnist for The Washington Post. Jared Bernstein with us as well. Senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, running some of the numbers from last night's Republican presidential debate focused largely on the economy. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Jared, a question about job creation. And this is one of the critiques that came up last night, that under President Obama, you know, small businesses or even businesses themselves have they're more likely to fold than to thrive. What's your analysis of that? Do we have our guest, Jared Bernstein? No, we seem to have lost him. Let's call him back. We'll call him back. Jennifer, it's just you and me, so we will carry on from there. Who would you say, do we have him? No, we don't.
Hello?
Okay, Jared, I'm sorry.
Oh, you got me?
We do.
Yeah, I've been here all the time.
I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry. So anyway, I thought that part of the discussion about the Obama record on the economy and on jobs was deeply misleading and even factually incorrect. This point about more small businesses closing than opening has been wrong for 2 to 3 years now. So that was the case a few years ago. It's not the case anymore, and all the fact checkers have been jumping on that this morning. And in terms of the actual number of jobs created, we're actually doing quite well. Obviously, last month we had a good jobs report, but looking over the long term, you've had a 60-plus record, an all-time record of just uninterrupted job growth month after month coming out of the Great Recession. And of course, we know that the Federal Reserve is champing at the bit to raise interest rates because they're afraid that the economy may be growing too quickly, generating inflationary pressures. So it's not a credible argument. I think if you wanted to go after Obama on the economy, your approach would be more on the wage side, and there you'd be again having to say the opposite of what Donald Trump said. Not that wages are too high, because that would sort of be a feather in Obama's cap if wages were too high. In fact, you know, wage growth has been stagnant for lots of people for lots of years. Now, that's not just an Obama phenomenon that preceded him by decades, and that has to do with inequalities that have been embedded in our economy since the late 1970s. But at least on the jobs front, lots of misinformation.
Interestingly, Jennifer, we haven't said anything about Jeb Bush, and I wonder whether that says something about his standing compared to the other candidates running for the White House.
I thought he had a better debate than he did the first three times out, but that is damning with faint praise. I think his difficulty comes not necessarily with substance, but with his demeanor and, frankly, his own upbringing, which is very polite and very deferential, and he does not have the ability to interject himself. We have long periods during the debate where he says nothing because he's not being directly called upon. And even when he is tussling with a candidate you would think would be able to get the better of John Kasich, he winds up deferring, leaving the floor to one of his opponents. That may seem like a small thing, but to viewers that denotes weakness, that denotes a lack of forthrightness. So I think he's got a ways to go in terms of coming back. I do think he staunched the bleeding last night. I think he assured some of his supporters that he understands that he has not had big debate performances before. I think he was, as I said, better than he had been. Mm-hmm. But I think the difficulty in this debate is, and in this primary system is that there are a lot of good people out there who do very well in these sorts of forum. And he's going to have problems, at least in the debate, making his way back. Maybe he's going to do it with paid and earned media. Maybe he's going to do it in other contexts. But in the debate itself, he's not, I think, going to be able to win it. Maybe he's going to be able to stop from losing it, but I don't think he's going to be able to out-debate Marco Rubio, for example, and really even some of the others.
Jared, I thought also an interesting disagreement that we heard last night was whether big banks should be allowed to fail. Now, this is something that Hillary Clinton has talked about and seems to be in favor, certainly under certain circumstances. What did you make of that back and forth?
Well, I think there seems to be, and this actually dates back to Mitt Romney's campaign as well. There seems to be a very much desire among the Republican field writ large to repeal the Dodd-Frank financial reforms. Now, this is a kind of a signal to kind of the banking or the financial community that they believe there's too much regulation on that part of the economy. Now, from an economist perspective, and I think this is at this point a fairly mainstream view, when the financial markets are underregulated, when there's not enough oversight, you end up with the kind of underpricing of risk that led to the housing bubble. Before that, it was a dot-com bubble. Before that, it was another real estate bubble that imploded in such a way that we're still kind of cleaning up some of the mess from that really devastating crisis. So it's pretty widely agreed upon outside of these kind of top end political circles that we need to do a better job of financial market oversight. So when I hear these groups talking about repealing Dodd-Frank and not going after the big banks and all that kind of thing, I get worried that there's another bubble in there somewhere. Mm. That doesn't mean that there can't be nuances, and we heard a little bit about that last night, but the general thematic there seems to be really kind of letting the financial markets rip in ways that haven't been very good for the overall macroeconomy.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to the two of you and to you, Jennifer, there was some interesting disagreement on Vladimir Putin. I think it was Rubio who called him a gangster. Trump seemed to think that he had a good relationship with this man. What did you make of that?
Because he met him in a green room.
Somewhere. Yes.
Well, I think, like many things that Donald Trump says, it's a bit puzzling, to put it mildly. I think we clearly have a Vladimir Putin problem. He in the Bush administration, he went into Georgia. Now he's into Ukraine and, of course, into Syria. I think it's a very important issue. And I think trying to make this into kind of a personality relationship issue. I had a meeting with him. I met him in the green room. I don't think in order to the benefit of these candidates, it makes them seem pretty silly. I think what we do need is a serious foreign policy embracing both hard and soft power to try to contain him, as well as the Chinese and many other forces around the world. A serious subject. Unfortunately, the people talking the most about it last night were not particularly serious.
Well, Jennifer Rupin, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And she's the Right Turn columnist for The Washington Post. Jared Bernstein, thank you for joining us as well.
You're welcome.
And he's senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And do stay with us. We've got a third guest waiting in the wings. We will carry on our conversation about last night's presidential debate. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about last night's Republican presidential candidates, with the candidates squaring off for the fourth time on a national stage, this time in Milwaukee at the Fox Business News Wall Street Journal sponsored debate. Eight candidates on the main stage, a smaller group of candidates on the undercard stage or debate. And this time it was geared largely toward the candidates' views on the economy and on business. Joining us now is Bob Cusick. He's the editor-in-chief at The Hill and has been reporting on policy and politics in the nation's capital since 1995. And Bob Cusick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So who do you think was the winner last night, if I can put it that way?
Well, I think the senators did very well. Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Cruz, and Senator Rand Paul. Rand Paul had I think, a very rough first three debates, and obviously it has showed in his polling. But I think the big story is Marco Rubio. He has been the most consistent debater, and I thought he was a clear winner last night. He looked poised. He obviously had that showdown with Jeb Bush.
Yep.
In the last debate, no such showdown this time around. I think Jeb Bush needed a big night. He did better than he did before. But he just did kind of okay. It wasn't a standout, clear winning performance that I think Jeb Bush needed.
How about someone like Ted Cruz? How do you think he did?
I think Ted Cruz is doing very well. He is very organized. His campaign is very organized. He is well-spoken. He is certainly anti-establishment. I think the big question for him is, if he wins the nomination, how can he beat Hillary Clinton? Now, if you look at the polls, head-to-head hypothetical matchups, he's doing pretty well. But some Republicans, and I think they have a good point, say Cruz would struggle to win independents. But he's a Tea Party star. He's a rock star on the right. And I think he is very well spoken, and people on the right are starting to get to know him if they didn't know him already. And I think he did very well. And there's a lot of people starting to think that the last two standing, if Carson and Trump fade, would be two senators, Cruz and Rubio.
He almost had an oops moment last night.
Yeah.
But he forgot. He named four of the five departments he would get rid of.
Yes, I believe he mentioned commerce twice.
And, yes.
And today he called it his Rick Perry moment, which is actually a good way of recovering when you make a gaffe, is to be self-deprecating. The thing that's a handicap for Cruz is that his likability, and he addressed that in the last debate where he said, well, you may not want to have a beer with me, but I'm the one who's going to drive you home. So I think that's an interesting take, because policy, generally speaking, is overrated. Voters like to like their presidents, and that's where Marco Rubio does very well. That's where actually Dr. Ben Carson does very well. His favorability numbers are extremely high. I think Carson did okay. I think Trump did okay, but it was probably his weakest debate performance to date. I don't think it's going to plummet their numbers. I don't think that the race changed dramatically, other than a lot of Republicans are starting to think that Marco Rubio could very well be the nominee, because he has done so well and because Jeb Bush has faltered. Now, those are establishment Republicans in this anti-establishment cycle. So it's very hard to predict what's going to happen next.
As you said, you thought Ben Carson did okay. But when you say that, I'm just, what is the criteria? Because as I was listening to him last night, I was trying to imagine, what would a Ben Carson administration be? I mean, what would their policies be? You know, if you listen carefully, there's not much there.
The Carson phenomenon is tough to explain. I think that the Trump phenomenon is a lot easier to explain. Carson is certainly, he has a personality that I think is engaging. He's an outsider, and people like that. He doesn't go on the attack like Trump, and I think people like that. But when you talk about specifics, and I agree, when you talk about his health care plan, he's been very fuzzy on that. People have gone after him saying he wants to end Medicare. He says no. So he's starting to get the scrutiny now that Trump was getting before, and attracting some of the same criticism that there's no meat on the bones. Where do you stand on this? I mean, just for as an example, last night on one of the first questions is that he said he does not support raising the minimum wage. Months ago, he said we should consider raising the minimum wage. So he's got a trouble with consistency, but he has a very strong following, and I think that helps, especially in a crowded field.
So consistency doesn't matter very much?
Well, I think it will. And remember, there are a lot of people in Iowa, in New Hampshire, and I was recently in New Hampshire. A lot of voters have not made up their mind. They like to see the candidates multiple times, talk to them on a one-on-one basis, and then they make up their minds. A lot of voters make up their minds in the last week or two. So if you're having a problem with consistency, and I think Carson is having it, clearly by the minimum wage question, he just needs to be clear and not contradict himself, because the words that can be the most harmful to you by your opponents are your own words. So I think he's going to have to be clear and actually say, okay, this is where I stand on healthcare, this is where I stand on fiscal issues, this is where I stand on taxes. But you can't. False results. He's doing quite well.
Let me read an email from Seth, who says, how do you feel about Governor Kasich? I feel like he made important points last night that have not been discussed in the media today, particularly his comment that the candidates need to offer realistic proposals. I wish he had not interrupted the other candidates so much, but he's not had as many questions in the earlier debates. And I have to say, Bob, even looking at it last night, he looked very frustrated. He looked like he was, you know, kind of pacing behind his podium there. Itching to get into the conversation, and he did sometimes.
He did, and I think that point was his high point, when he said, listen, we have to be realistic. We can't deport 11 million people. That's just fantasy. That's not real. A lot of experts believe that. But at the same time, I agree. He looked frustrated. I think he had a terrible night. He had a great first debate. He had home crowd advantage in Ohio during that debate. But since then, he has struggled. And I think he was the clear loser of the debate last night because he looked at his body language. He was just impatient. He was trying to cut in. Yes, he had a couple good lines, but overall, he did not connect. And when you look frustrated, that just doesn't work in presidential debates.
How about the undercard debate? And is that a gambling? I forget where that word comes from, but it's such an interesting word to use. But nonetheless, the four candidates that didn't make it to the big stage last night, many people are saying Governor Christie really kind of wiped the slate last night. Yes?
Yeah. And, undercard is actually, it refers to boxing undercard.
Oh, okay.
And Christie's a fighter. And he showed that once again. Christie has been, I think, very good in all of the debates he's been in. And I think he did extremely well when Bobby Jindal, who has struggled to gain any traction, maybe a little bit in Iowa, but overall, he's been in all the undercard debates. He would repeatedly attack Christie. And I thought some of the lines were pretty good. But Christie wouldn't take the bait. He just kept the focus on, I can beat Hillary Clinton, and he would not go toe-to-toe with Jindal. And I think that was actually very smart. Now, the problem for Christie is even though he has a conservative entitlement reform plan on Medicare and Social Security, the base just doesn't forgive him for what he did in 2012, working with President Obama on Hurricane Sandy and that October surprise. So Christie's done a lot of things right. It's just not working in the numbers for him, and he's been on TV a lot. He goes on Fox a lot. I think his campaign has been very well run. He just hasn't been able to get into double digits.
And is President Obama going to New Jersey in the midst of the Sandy crisis and the fact that they look so friendly together, that's really hurt him among Republicans?
Yes. I think so. Not for independent voters, but for the Republican base who really thought that President Obama could have and should have been beaten in 2012 by Mitt Romney. Now, that did not have an impact on the race as far as who won and who lost. It certainly helped President Obama. At the time, it helped Governor Christie, too, in his home state. But I just don't think they'll forgive him for that. And they also think listen, this is a governor from New Jersey, from a blue state. Some of his positions that they don't think that he's conservative enough. So it's not just Sandy, but Sandy's a big part of it, I think.
And that's Bob Cusick. He's the editor-in-chief at The Hill. He's been reporting on policy and politics in the nation's capital since 1995. The third of three guests as we talk about last night's presidential debate among the Republicans, and something we've been doing and we will continue to do on Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We want your opinion about what happened last night. You can send us an email. I see a bunch on my screen here, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Bob, it seems the Republicans have picked the candidate from the Democratic Party, and that would be Hillary Clinton. Her name came up a lot last night.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about beating Hillary Clinton. And when it comes down to it, that's where a lot of voters are going to vote. And you've seen that on both sides throughout the years, whether that's Mitt Romney being selected as the nominee or Democrats picking John Kerry to face off against George W. Bush in 2004, they made the calculation, okay, this guy has the best shot to win, and, of course, those two candidates didn't win, but they desperately want to win the White House. And there's a real opportunity for the Republican Party, even though it has struggled with its brand. If you look at the makeup of Congress, the House is certainly going to stay in Republican hands. The Senate is up for grabs, but if there's a Republican president, in all likelihood, the Senate will stay in Republican hands. So then the Republicans could have control of the House, the Senate, and the White House in 2017. Democrats are not going to get all three, certainly because of the big advantage in the House. So this is such a – it's always a huge prize, but this is such a big prize because they feel like if we get – all three, then we can repeal a lot of what Obama has done over the last year. So, Republicans privately, they're not very scared of Hillary Clinton. The Democrats, of course, opened with a huge electoral map advantage because of the demographics of the country, and Hispanic votes certainly in recent elections going to the Democrats. And that's why some Republicans think a Marco Rubio or a Jeb Bush, if he can make a comeback, would help with Hispanic voters and independent voters. But, you know, there are some states that Republicans have to win, and that includes Florida, and that includes Ohio.
Well, and I thought it was interesting last night to Jeb Bush when he sort of was his moment to shine when he said, look, the Democrats are high-fiving because of the way that we talk about immigration and illegal immigrants.
Yes. It was a different crowd in Milwaukee than in prior debates. It seemed more more moderate. And when you talked about immigration and you had lines from Ted Cruz and hardline lines from Trump or Cruz that would get a lot of applause the last time or in prior debates. This time it was different. Jeb Bush was getting a lot of applause for making those type of comments that, listen, you know, if we're going to win, we cannot just say we're going to deport 11 million people. It's just not going to work in the general election. So I think Jeb had a good moment there. But he's going to have a lot more moments. He was more forceful. He seemed unsteady in prior debates. Last night he was steady but unspectacular. And donors are getting the Bush donors are getting nervous, certainly. I mean, we are headed toward Thanksgiving. Everyone thought that Trump and Carson would fall by now. Trump has been one or two since late July. So this has some Republicans very nervous that there are still a lot of candidates, and that helps the candidacies of Trump and Carson, who have such a devout 15% to 20% following.
I was talking about this with our previous guest, but I thought it was so interesting that Donald Trump got booed last night, one with a pretty snarky comment about Fiorina interrupting everybody. He also kind of diminished Kasich and sort of said, look, I'm a rich businessman. I don't have to deal with you, or some version of that.
Right.
You know, what do you think is going on with him?
Well, he's irritated by Fiorina. We've interviewed Trump a couple times. He doesn't take Fiorina seriously as far as her winning the nomination. He does not think that she can go all the way.
Because she's a woman? Is that an issue for him?
Well, I just think that he doesn't think that she has the personality or really attracts the headlines that you need to. Whether you're Rubio or Trump, Fiorina has done well on the debates, but in between the debates, she kind of disappears, and partly is because she's not making news. The part of the Trump phenomenon is that he gives journalists something new to write about. I don't think he gave us a lot of news last night, and that's why I think he struggled, and he is irritated by Fiorina, and he's gone after her, obviously, several times, some in a controversial way when he said, look at her face,
exactly,
that she can't be president. But and I think that did hurt him, and that is something that is not going to help him if he continues to do that. He does prey on weak challenges. Preying on John Kasich, no doubt about it. And he's done that with others like Rand Paul and Jeb Bush.
Well, on that note, Bob Cusick, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem. And he's the editor-in-chief at The Hill. He's been reporting on policy and politics in Washington, D.C. since 1995. Also talked with Jennifer Rubin earlier in the hour. She's the right-turn columnist for The Washington Post. And Jared Bernstein, he's senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.